there was a cocktail party followed by dinner. Dinner was a buffet, and despite the warnings about eating salads and vegetables, we saw many people eating them anyway. And just as the doctor predicted, more than a dozen would become ill within days. Some would remain sick throughout the rest of the trip. We dined that night with Bob and Kate Devlin, who split their time between Connecticut and New York City, and with whom we formed an immediate connection. They had two sons approximately our age, and they said we reminded them of their kids. For us, the connection seemed just as personal. "Doesn't Kate remind you of Mom?" Micah asked as we were heading back to our room. "Yeah, she does," I answered, amazed that he'd been thinking exactly the same thing as I. Lost in thought, we didn't say much else the rest of the night. Because it was the hub of Mayan life, Tikal has been declared a World Heritage Site by UNESCO. Discovery, excavation, and repairs have been ongoing for decades, and despite the number of visitors, it takes a small army to keep the jungle at bay. At one time, the area surrounding Tikal was home to 100,000 people, all of whom depended on the city for protection and trade. By the end of the 10th century, however, the civilization began to disintegrate. A number of theories abound as to the reason: overpopulation, wars, an overthrow of the ruling class, drought, famine, dwindling nutrient capacity of the soil, or simple discontent of the people that led them to find opportunities with other invading tribes. But within a few generations, the city had been completely abandoned and the people dispersed back into the countryside. The rise and sudden fall of the Maya is still considered one of the world's great mysteries, and I was thinking about it as we made our way to the ancient city. The ruins of Tikal include some 3,000 structures, including palaces, temples, platforms, ball courts, plazas, and terraces built over a period of 600 years. Thus, some sections are significantly older than others, and it's possible to observe the changing architecture of the Maya, which enables archaeologists to accurately date other Mayan sites throughout Central America and Mexico. It was the sacrificial stones, however, that intrigued my brother. These were the stones upon which people had been killed as offerings to the gods. Our Maya guide was proudly discussing the historical and cultural reasons for the stones when Micah leaned over and whispered, "Have someone get a picture of me lying on the stone while you pretend to stab me. Wouldn't that be cool?" Actually, I found the thought a little morbid, but I reluctantly agreed. I handed over the camera and we got ourselves into position. Just as the picture was about to be taken, the guide came rushing over, waving his arms to stop us. "No, no," he was shouting, his face reddening. "You can't lie on the stones and take pictures. They have great religious significance." "I know," Micah countered. "That's why I want the picture." "It's not allowed. Just one picture." "No." "Aw," he said, winking. "Just one. We won't tell anyone." Though I laughed, the guide glowered. He was Maya, as were most Guatemalans who lived in the area, and I'm sure he thought we were insulting him or his culture. When he didn't crack a smile, Micah reluctantly got up from the stone. As we began trailing after the group, I shook my head. "Where do you come up with these ideas?" I asked in disbelief. Micah laughed. "He didn't like that much, did he?" I shook my head. "He looked pretty mad, and so did the people running the tour. You're insulting their culture. You're gonna get us in trouble." "Ah, they'll get over it. They won't even remember it." They did, of course. An hour later, one of the people who worked for TCS sidled up to us as we were walking. She was maybe a dozen years older than we were and had worked on numerous tours. She was well-versed in the art of sizing people up quickly. "You two are going to cause trouble on this trip, aren't you?" she observed. We walked along what was once the main boulevard entering Tikal, touring the ruins of a palace while howler monkeys screeched their warnings overhead. From there, we moved on to the main plaza. Two pyramids lie at either end of Tikal's main plaza. They are among the most photographed of all Mayan pyramids, and while one of the pyramids is off-limits to climbers, we were allowed to scale the second one. At the top, the view was breathtaking. Micah finally reached Christine, and when he was finished with the call, we sat on the edge of the pyramid, our feet dangling beneath us. The ground was hundreds of feet below, and we could see other members of the tour clustered in small groups throughout the ancient plaza. Since only a few wanted to make the climb, we had the place to ourselves. "So how's Christine?" I asked. "She's all right. Says she misses me." "How's life on the home front so far?" He smiled. "She's going a little crazy. Unlike Kat, she isn't used to me being gone. She kept talking about how busy she was. She hasn't stopped since I went to the airport. She said it's been 4 days of hell, and that she's going to call Kathy for moral support." I smiled. Tell her to call while the older kids are in school, otherwise Kat won't have a chance to talk to her. Once all five are home, the house goes crazy, especially between 5 and 9. We call those the witching hours. That's when the little ones get tired, the older ones groan about having to do their homework, she starts cooking dinner, and still somehow manages to run the kids from one practice to the next. After that comes bath time, and if you've ever tried to get 5 kids tubbing and showering at once, you know it's not exactly relaxing. She's got such a good attitude about it. She's a great wife, but she's a genius as a mother. Micah put his arm around me. We married well, didn't we? Yeah, we did, I admitted. I think that's what we learned from Mom. What to look for when we got married, I mean. We both married smart women with big hearts who adore their children unequivocally. That's what Mom taught us. Are you saying I essentially married my mother? We both did. He cocked an eyebrow. What did we learn from Dad? Anger management, I cracked. You know, the tongue thing? He laughed. Yeah, that was something, wasn't it? Man, he looked pretty scary when he did that. It still gives me nightmares. He glanced at me. Did I tell you I did that to Allie once, just to see how she'd react? And? She ran away screaming and wouldn't come out of her room. I laughed. No, what I think we got from Dad was our love of learning, I said after a moment. I think so, too. Growing up, I thought Mom was smart, very smart. But Dad, he was in his own league. They were quite a pair, weren't they? Yeah, he said. And they balanced each other out. Who knows how we would have turned out had they not gotten back together after our stint in Grand Island. On December 1st, 1974, our family was reunited in Fair Oaks, California, a suburb just northeast of Sacramento. Within minutes of our arrival, my dad turned on the television to watch Kolchak, The Night Stalker, a campy though utterly watchable horror series that was far and away my dad's favorite. Soon, the three of us were seated beside my dad on the couch, eating popcorn and watching something scary on TV, almost believing that we'd never been away from him at all. Our house, another rental, of course, had 4 bedrooms, an almost unfathomable luxury in our young minds. Yet I couldn't help but notice that my father had claimed one of the bedrooms as his office. With the master bedroom obviously taken, that left 2 bedrooms for the 3 of us kids. And my mom quickly announced that my sister would be the one to have her own room, the reason being, she's a girl. Because it was so late in the first term, our parents held us out of school until after the new year, when the new term started. My parents also bought a dog, a Doberman Pinscher named Brandy. And as we always did in new places, my brother and I set out to explore, this time with our dog in tow. Our street dead-ended a few houses up, bordering on what seemed like wilderness, and our first instinct was to learn the terrain. Nowadays, Fair Oaks is almost completely developed, but back then there were wide-open fields and hills, an abandoned house and climbing trees, everything young boys need to have fun. Even better, we weren't the only kids our age on the street. Almost all of our neighbors had led a nomadic lifestyle, similar to ours, so it wasn't as if we were the only new kids on the block. In the afternoons, they would play on the street outside, and gradually my brother and I got to know them. And as it happened in Nebraska, my brother soon began leaving me behind, preferring the company of his newfound friends. Despite the fact that my parents had reunited, they continued to lead largely separate lives. My mom, who had taken another job as an optometrist's assistant, would rise with us and get us off to school while my father slept. After she got off work, she'd come home to an empty house 2 or 3 evenings a week, since my father sometimes had to teach at night. On those evenings he didn't have to teach, my dad would either grade papers and exams or read, hoping to keep abreast in his chosen field of study. Like all professors, he was also pressed to publish, and he could frequently be heard typing in his office. Occasionally my mom and dad would bump into each other in the kitchen, but in general they seemed to spend little time together. While it would be easy to surmise that they didn't enjoy each other's company, neither one seemed to go out of the way to visit with the other after all, they had a comfortable relationship. They joked and laughed at the kitchen table over dinner, and I sometimes even caught my dad nuzzling the back of my mom's neck when they didn't realize I was watching. While they weren't overtly affectionate most of the time, they weren't needy, possessive, or jealous either. I never heard either of them say something negative about the other, and I seldom heard them argue anymore. They put the past behind them more successfully than most, and seemed to be exactly what the other one needed. To that point, they'd lived a life of sacrifice, and I think that united them as well. Neither, after all, was living the life of their dreams. My dad wanted a life with less pressure and fewer financial worries. While he didn't desire great wealth, he was frequently discouraged by the daily struggle of keeping the family afloat. Nor could he envision any change in the future, and that weighed on him as well. My mom was no different. Once I found her crying in the bedroom, and the discovery terrified me. It was so unlike her that I began to tear up as well, and my mom pulled me close. "I was just thinking how nice it would be to live in the country with horses like I did when I was little," she said. "Maybe with a little house where we could go riding on the weekends. It would just be so wonderful. I wish we would have been able to give that kind of life to you kids." Dreams are always crushing when they don't come true. But it's the simple dreams that are often the most painful because they seem so personal, so reasonable, so attainable. You're always close enough to touch, but never quite close enough to hold, and it's enough to break your heart. As for Micah and me, our lives over the next 4 years fell into a relatively distinct pattern. My brother continued to spread his wings and found new friends easily. My sister made good friends as well, and one of them quickly became like a sister to her. I, on the other hand, had less luck in maintaining friendships. Not because there was anything wrong with me, per se, at least I like to think so, but rather because of simple bad luck. My best friend in third grade was Tim. In fourth grade, he transferred to the parochial school, and our paths seldom crossed again. My best friend in fourth grade was Andy. In the fifth grade, he transferred to the parochial school as well, and I didn't see him again either. In fifth grade, my best friend was Warren. In the sixth grade, he moved to Australia. In sixth grade, my best friend was Kevin. When we went off to middle school the following year, we never had a single class together. My brother, on the other hand, was much more fortunate, and the friendships he made grew only stronger over the years. None of the kids ever moved away, none ever transferred to a different school. Like Micah, his friends tended to be adventurous, and afternoons and weekends were spent either in the fields near our house or at the American River a few miles away. Meanwhile, I began to find more and more pleasure in the solitary act of reading. Because we couldn't afford to buy books and the town library was extremely small with relatively few titles, there wasn't much to choose from except for the set of Encyclopedia Britannica at home. With no other options, I began with the first volume. And over the next 2 years, I read through the entire set of 26 volumes, one miscellaneous entry at a time. When I finished, I read them all again. Then I read the Bible from cover to cover. This isn't to say I read all the time, or even most of the time. Because we were latchkey kids, again, the outside world was always beckoning, and there were even times that Micah's group of friends would get together with my friends, when it almost felt like old times. We used to enjoy playing with the BB guns our parents got us for Christmas 1 year. While I suppose this is common for boys our age, what wasn't common was what we did with them. Essentially, my brother and I, along with whoever else was stupid enough to join us, quickly learned that it was less exciting to shoot at targets than at each other, and the game we developed was simple. Someone shouted go, we'd all scramble through the woods or into the abandoned house, then hunt each other down. There were no teams, it was every man for himself, and there was no real end to the game either. You simply kept hiding and hunting and shooting each other until dinner time, when everyone had to go home. There were only two rules. No shooting in the face, and you could only pump the BB gun twice, which limited the velocity somewhat. But even those rules were more guidelines than strictly enforced rules. Consequently, everyone cheated. There was a perverse joy in shooting at someone, hearing them scream, and watching them dance in circles, holding the wound, trying to get rid of the sting. Of course, what goes around comes around, and I spent years with welts all over my body. On more occasions than I can remember, each of us had to push out a BB that had embedded itself into our skin. Micah, though, always seemed to suffer injuries worse than any of us. Part of it was because he was always pushing, always trying to do more. Once when he was playing with his BB gun in a garbage-strewn abandoned house, he thought it would be fun to kick out the rest of a window that had long since been broken. I suppose he was imitating what he saw people do on television, but no one told him that on TV they use special glass that doesn't shatter. Anyway, after kicking out the window and shooting someone circling the house, he knew it was time to find the next hiding place, and started to leave. The next thing he knew, he heard a squishing noise coming from his shoe. Figuring that he must have stepped in a puddle of some unknown liquid, he kept going, trying to ignore it. As he put it, "But I realized the squishing only seemed to be growing louder. When I looked down at my shoe, I noticed that my sock was turning pink, and my shoe was soaked. Obviously, I told myself, I'd stepped in some wine left behind by some teenagers. So there I was, step, squish, step, squish. And I could feel my foot getting slimier. And then I suddenly realized that I must have cut myself on the glass. So I sat down and took off my shoe. My sock and shoe were soaked in blood, and all of a sudden the blood spurts from a cut over my ankle like water from a drinking fountain. It spurted high with every heartbeat. Looking back, I must have cut or at least nicked an artery because it was really spurting. He yelled for his friend who came running. Using the bloody sock, they put a tourniquet on the ankle, and with his friend's help, my brother hobbled home and called for my mom. Because it was a weekend, she happened to be at home, and she examined his ankle as it spurted blood all over the kitchen linoleum. "Looks pretty bad," she said succinctly. And as always, she knew exactly what to do. She stuck a Band-Aid on it. Then she told Micah to put his hand over the Band-Aid and told him he might want to rest it for a while before he went outside to play again. As wild as we were, my mom always made it a point to bring us to church every Sunday, and that continued in California. My brother and I were often bored and would poke each other. The challenge, however, was that the other wasn't allowed to flinch, and the poker couldn't appear to be moving, so that our mother wouldn't catch us. Dana didn't like this particular game very much, and while my mother didn't know what was going on, my sister certainly did. She took church very seriously because our mom did. I suppose she wanted to be just like her. And in between her prayers, she would frown at us, trying to get us to stop. Dana loved to pray. She prayed in the morning. She prayed at night. She asked God to bless everyone she knew, one at a time. She prayed for relatives and friends and strangers, dogs and cats and animals at the zoo. She prayed to become kinder and more patient, despite the fact that she didn't need help in either department. She seemed completely at ease with the world and had a way of making others comfortable around her. In her own gentle way, my sister had quietly become the rock that my brother and I began to cling to whenever misfortune befell us. But as much as Dana loved church and praying, it was her fault that we never arrived at Mass on time. Usually, we rolled in about 10 minutes late, and always after the rest of the congregation was seated. I didn't mind coming late. As I said, I was frequently bored. But I didn't like the way everyone would turn to watch us as we tried to find a seat. And in moments like those, I wished my sister would be a little more like my brother and me, at least in one respect. Dana, despite her other wonderful qualities, was not a fast mover. When she woke up in the morning, she never got out of bed right away. Instead, she would sit cross-legged on the mattress and simply stare into space, looking dreamy and disoriented. She would stay in that position for 20 minutes, waking up, as she described it, and would only then begin getting ready to go. And even then, everything was slow. She ate slowly, she dressed slowly, she brushed her hair slowly. Where our mom could tell Micah and me to get ready and we'd be dressed within minutes, my sister took her time. My brother and I had to walk to school, but more often than not, my mom would have to drive my sister in so that she wouldn't be late. It made us crazy at times, but she never let our complaints bother her. "People are just different," Dana used to observe serenely, whenever we'd tease her about it. And my mom never let my sister's lateness bother her. As she explained it to us, "She just needs a little more time to get ready." "Why?" Mike or I would ask. "Because she's a girl." "Oh." Still, Dana had the occasional wild impulse. On our one and only cross-country vacation in the summer of 1976, the family loaded into our Volkswagen van, the only car we had from 1974 to 1982, and spent a few weeks traveling around the West. We visited the Painted Desert and Taos, New Mexico, before finally arriving at the Grand Canyon. It was, of course, one of the greatest sights in the world. But as children, we didn't much appreciate it. Instead, on my sister's suggestion, we decided it would be much more fun to slip behind the viewing ropes and approach the unstable, cordoned-off edge of the canyon while our parents were buying us lunch. There, we discovered a small ledge maybe 3 feet down. "Let's go down there," my sister suggested. Micah and I looked at each other, glanced at the ledge, and shrugged. "Okay," we replied. "I mean, why not? How dangerous could it be? It didn't look too unstable." Anyway, we climbed down and sat on the ledge for a few minutes, three little kids with their legs dangling free. Far beneath us, we could see the Colorado River snaking through the canyon and hawks circling below. The differing strata of rock resembled a soft-hued vertical rainbow. After a while, however, we got bored. "Hey," my sister said, "I have an idea. Let's pretend we slipped off the edge of the canyon and scare people. Micah and I looked at each other again, impressed. This would normally have been one of our ideas. Okay, we answered in unison. Now, squatting on the ledge, we raised ourselves slowly and poked our heads and arms over the top of the canyon. No one noticed us at first. Beyond the ropes about 30 feet away, we could see a group of people taking pictures and staring off in different directions, marveling at the natural beauty. When my sister nodded, we suddenly began screaming for help at the top of our lungs. Heads immediately whipped in our direction, and people saw what seemed to be three little children clawing for their lives in an attempt to hold on. An older woman swooned, another grabbed at her heart, another clutched at her husband's arm. No one seemed to know what to do. They continued staring at us with wide, fearful eyes, frozen by shock and horror. Finally, one man broke free from the spell he was under and was stepping over the rope when we saw my mom come rushing toward us. You can probably guess what happened next. "Stay there while I take a picture, kids," my mom yelled. As fun as it was, sadly, we couldn't stay at the Grand Canyon. A few minutes later, our family was told that we had to leave. Now, as the ranger on duty so kindly put it. 6 months later, my brother and I had our BB guns confiscated by the sheriff. Not because of the BB gun wars, but because my brother went a little too far. Basically, what happened was this. There was no one to play war with one afternoon, so my brother recruited a couple of first graders for a different kind of game. He told them to bend over and hold the cuffs of their pant legs out, so he could shoot through the material. "Now don't move or I might accidentally shoot your leg," Micah explained patiently. "I just want to practice my aim." Anyway, as I said, the sheriff came and took away his gun. A week later, they came again and took my gun, too. My brother had used it to shoot holes in a couple of neighbors' windows. And just like that, our days playing war were over. Chapter 7, Lima, Peru. Sunday, January 26th. When it was time to bid farewell to Guatemala, we boarded our plane and headed to our next stop, Lima, Peru, a city of 8 million and home to nearly a third of Peru's population. Once the capital of the Spanish Empire, encompassing Ecuador, Colombia, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, and Peru, Lima was one of the world's wealthiest and most luxurious cities in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Exploitation, mismanagement, and poor planning eventually weakened the Spanish Empire, however, leading to Simón Bolívar's eventual rout of the Spanish forces in 1824. A succession of governments over the next 175 years finally led to democratic elections in 1980, and I was anxious to see how the country was faring. Lima was sweltering when we landed. It was summer in South America, far warmer than it had been in Guatemala. As we boarded buses, TCS handed out bottles of water and introduced the local tour guides, who would speak to us about the culture and history of the places we visited. We were also given a radio and earpiece, which we turned to the same frequency as our guide. Thus, even up to 100 feet away, we could always hear what was going on. The central plaza was crowded when we arrived. It was one of the few open areas in the center of the city, colonial in design and crisscrossed with curving sidewalks lined with freshly planted flowers. Kids played games in the grass and played in the fountains, trying to keep cool in the summer heat. Others did their best to sell us souvenirs and crowded around our group the moment we stepped off the bus. We took photographs of both the presidential palace and the cathedral where Francisco Pizarro was buried. Pizarro, I knew, was one in a long line of historical figures whose reputation largely depends on perspective. While known in Spain as an explorer, he had also captured Atahualpa, the leader of the Incas. When he demanded and received as ransom a room full of gold for his release, he promptly executed the king anyway before enslaving the natives. I couldn't help but wonder what the descendants of the Incas thought about his church-sanctioned burial place. From there, we made our way to Casa Aliaga, which was located just off the main plaza. Literally, Aliaga's house, it was one of the most striking examples of early Spanish architecture in the city. Yet from the outside, it blended into the other structures on the block. Unless you knew it was there, a person could walk by without noticing it. Beyond the doors, however, was a home that boggled the mind. Casa Aliaga has been owned by the Aliaga family for over 400 years. It is still occupied by the Aliagas today. Designed in typical hacienda fashion, Rooms surround an open courtyard, complete with a 100-foot-tall fig tree stretching to the sky. It is also home to one of the finest art collections in South America. Because the house is so large and expensive to maintain, the Aliagas open the house to tourists. And Micah and I wandered through with wide eyes. Everything, with the exception of the plaster walls, the banisters, door frames, crown moldings, and railings, had been intricately carved, and paintings covered every available wall space. The furniture, mostly from the 17th and 18th centuries, was so ornate that it was impossible for us to bring our cameras into focus. As we were walking through the house, Micah finally turned to me. "Can you believe this place? No, that tree, well, everything, really. It's incredible. I'll bet you're getting some good ideas for the next time you remodel, huh?" I laughed. "I have to admit that it would be nice to have paintings of famous ancestors."
"You mean if we had any?"
"Exactly. While the Aliaga family was building this place, our ancestors were probably putting shoes on horses and working on the farm." He nodded and looked around. Our group had dispersed throughout various rooms in the house. "Be honest, though, would you want to live here?" I shook my head. "No," I said. "It's unbelievable, but it's not really my style. And the upkeep must keep the owners awake at night."
"I know what you mean. I mean, can you imagine how long it takes to dust this place? Christine would die."
The TCS group began herding us together, counting heads and making sure everyone was accounted for. After leaving Casa Aliaga, we climbed back on the bus for the ride to the hotel. This would become our routine over the next few weeks. While a tour like ours has advantages, the schedule is carefully predetermined, and in many places there's little time to linger or explore on your own. It was the night of the Super Bowl. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers were playing the Oakland Raiders, and a number of people in the tour wanted to watch it, including Micah. Because he lived in Sacramento, the Raiders were his favorite team, and he'd even been to a few games that year. We weren't even sure the game would be broadcast in Peru, and there was a veritable whoop on the bus when TCS confirmed that it would be. The game would be on via satellite in the bar and would stay tuned there throughout the game. Apparently, this required a bit of finagling by the crew of TCS. Few people in Peru cared about the Super Bowl, and a soccer game, which was important to Peruvians, wouldn't be shown. Wanting a good seat, Micah and I were among the first to arrive, and we began ordering traditional pregame goodies. Others gradually joined us. Half the crowd favored Tampa Bay, the other half favored Oakland, and by the time it was ready for the game to begin, the hotel bar looked like a bar in any city in the United States. There wasn't a local anywhere near the place. There was no pregame show. Instead, roughly 5 minutes before the start of the game, the television flickered once or twice, and we found ourselves watching the teams lining up for the kickoff. "See? Everything we're doing is new," Micah said. "Be honest. Who do you know who's ever watched the Super Bowl in Lima?"
"No one," I admitted.
"Having fun yet?"
"Having a blast," I answered.
"You thinking about work?"
"Nope, just thinking about the game."
He waved a French fry at me.
"Good.
There's hope for you yet."
"Turn it up," someone yelled from behind us. "We can't hear in the back."
The bartender used the remote, and the volume began to rise. With it, the familiar sound started to register. We heard the roar of the crowd, the names of the players as they were announced in the stadium, then the coin toss. Only then did the announcers begin their commentary. Everyone leaned forward.
"What the hell are they saying?" someone shouted.
"I don't know," another answered.
"I think they're announcing it in Spanish."
Of course. It made perfect sense once you thought about it.
Spanish?
"It's the official language of Peru," Micah offered, "and Spain." No one thought it was funny.
"I thought it was coming in on satellite," someone grumbled.
"From the States. Maybe it's in English on another channel." The bartender surfed around. This was it. Spanish or nothing. I leaned toward Micah.
"Now you really have a story to tell," I said.
"Not only did you see your favorite team play in the Super Bowl in Lima, Peru, but you can tell them you heard it in Spanish."
"Now you're getting in the spirit. That's exactly what I was going to say."
We settled in to watch the game. The Raiders weren't playing well and quickly fell behind. Micah's cheers gradually grew more infrequent, and by halftime he was shaking his head.
"You gotta have faith," I urged.
"I think I'm losing it."
"I've heard that," I said pointedly, recalling my previous conversations I'd had with his wife, Christine.
"So are you still avoiding church?"
He smiled but didn't look at me. Faith and religion was a subject we often discussed, even through our early years.
Since Micah had married, however, the subject had been coming up more regularly. Christine wasn't Catholic, and instead of going to Mass, they attended a non-denominational Christian service. Unlike the Mass I preferred, which is highly traditional, with only slight variation from week to week, Micah preferred a service with less structure and more time for personal reflection. Or more accurately, those were his original reasons when he explained the change to me. But lately, even those differences hadn't seemed to matter. Let me guess. Christine told you to ask me about this on the trip, didn't she? I said nothing. Micah shifted in his seat. No, I go sometimes, but only because Christine wants me to. She thinks it's important for me to go because of the kids. And? And what? Are you getting anything out of it? Not really. Are you praying at all? I haven't prayed in 3 years. A life without prayer is something I couldn't imagine. In no small way, I'd been depending on prayer for as long as he'd been avoiding it. Don't you feel like you're missing something? I don't pray because it doesn't work, he said curtly. Prayer doesn't fix anything. Bad things happen anyway. Don't you think it helps you handle those bad times, though? He didn't answer. And by his silence, I knew he didn't want to talk about it. Not yet, anyway. In the end, the game was a blowout. Tampa Bay had the game in hand, and Micah and I left the bar to work out in the hotel gym during the second half. We jogged and lifted weights. Afterward, we went back to our room and collapsed on the bed. Sorry your team lost, I said. No big deal, he said. I'm not like you used to be. Remember, back when you were a kid? You used to cry whenever the Vikings lost. The Minnesota Vikings had been my favorite team growing up. I'd pick them because it was where Dana was born. I remember. It broke my heart when they lost the Super Bowl. Which one? They lost a bunch of them. Thanks for reminding me. No problem, he paused. You do know you were nuts when it came to the Vikings, don't you? I know, I tended to go overboard in a lot of things. You still do. We all have our problems, even you. That's untrue. I'm perfectly happy. Haven't you noticed? It was I who, through the sheer force of my buoyant personality, lifted you from the depths of despair only a couple of days ago? I rolled my eyes. That's just because we're on the trip. You have to remember, doing something like this has always been more your style than mine. You grew up loving adventure. You used to search it out. I just tagged along trying to keep you from getting into too much trouble. He grinned. I did get into trouble a lot, didn't I? Quite a bit, actually. Especially when it came to weapons. A look of fond reminiscence crossed his face. You know, I just don't understand why that happened. I wasn't a bad kid. I was just trying to have a good time. I smiled, thinking, good times indeed. My parents, being the wise and wonderful folks they were, finally realized Micah and I weren't exactly responsible when it came to BB guns, despite the good times we had had with them. No matter how much we begged, they refused to buy us new ones. Nor would they consider giving us rifles when we offered that by way of compromise. Instead, they bought us bows and arrows. We had fun with those bows. Our aim wasn't too good, but what we lacked in accuracy, we made up for with velocity. We could send those arrows humming, practically burying them into trees. My brother took to it a bit more easily than I did, and eventually got to the point where he could actually hit a fairly large target from 30 feet away at least 5% of the time, as opposed to my 3% of the time. Hey, let's put an apple on your head and I'll try to shoot it off, he finally suggested. I have a better idea, I said. Let's put the apple on your head. Maybe it's not such a good idea. One day when we were out with our bows and arrows in the woods, one of the arrows went astray, heading toward a group of workers that were framing a house. In the years since we'd moved there, construction on new homes had begun in earnest. Now, the arrow hadn't landed too close to the workers, but it wasn't too far away either. And one of the carpenters got pretty mad at us, even when we tried to explain that it was an accident. Don't even think about shooting arrows around here, he growled. And even worse, he refused to give us the arrow back, no matter how much we pleaded. Since we had only 3 arrows to begin with, losing one was a big deal. My brother and I skulked off, heading back up the hill toward our street again, seething. By the time we reached the top of the hill, my brother decided that he wasn't about to follow some stranger's orders, especially since he'd kept the arrow. As he put it, he can't tell me what to do. My brother loaded an arrow and tightened the bow, then leaned back with the intention of shooting the arrow straight up into the sky in a statement of defiance, a sort of, take that. He launched the arrow and it zoomed skyward higher and higher until it was just a speck in the sky.
Of course he hadn't taken note of the light breeze that afternoon, nor did my brother actually shoot straight up. Though as God is my witness, that was his intention. Instead, the arrow had just enough angle to sort of veer in the direction of the house and workers at the bottom of the hill, and the wind took over from there. I watched the arrow's changing trajectory, feeling my chest begin to constrict as I realized where it was heading. "Micah, is that arrow heading where I think it is?" "Oh, no. No, 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 no!" My brother, turning white like me, was hopping up and down in ardent denial as if hoping to change the obvious. We watched the arrow as it began arcing downward toward the worker who'd confiscated the previous arrow. Had Micah aimed, had he purposely been trying, there wasn't a chance he'd ever launch an arrow 200 yards with such accuracy. "No, no!" Micah screamed, continuing to hop up and down. I watched the arrow descending toward doom itself, sure with every passing second that we were actually going to kill the guy. Never had I been so terrified. Time seemed to slow down, everything move with dreadful determination. I knew we'd end up in juvenile hall, maybe even prison. And then it was over. The arrow hit the ground less than a foot from where the man was working with the shovel, landing in a poof of dust. He jumped to the side in shock and horror. "Oh, thank God," Micah said with a long sigh. He smiled. "You got that right," I agreed. "That was close." Of course, at that age, and in that particular moment, we weren't able to fathom how the worker might view this particular incident. Unlike us, he wasn't thankful at all. One minute he's doing his job, and the next minute he's nearly impaled by an arrow launched by two kids at the top of the hill. No, he wasn't thankful, not even a little bit. He was enraged. Even from 200 yards, we saw him raise his eyes toward us, toss his shovel aside, and start racing for his truck. "You think we ought to run?" I asked, turning to Micah. But Micah was already gone, racing back toward our street, his legs moving as fast as I'd ever seen them. I ran after him. 30 seconds later, as I was chugging across neighbors' lawns, I glanced over my shoulder and saw the truck come to a screeching halt at the edge of the woods. So the man jumped from the truck and started chasing us the rest of the way on foot. Oh, he caught us all right, and he was even madder up close than he was far away. When my dad learned what happened, he was mad too, and we were grounded for a couple of weeks. Even worse, later that afternoon, the sheriff came and confiscated our bows and arrows. With the exception of the one trip to the Grand Canyon, our vacations would be spent with relatives in San Diego. For whatever reason, the majority of both my mother's and father's family had moved there, and consequently we were able to visit them and enjoy the beach without having to spend much money. A good thing, I might add, for a family that didn't have any to spare. We would always drive the 10 hours it took to get there, the three of us crammed into the back of the Volkswagen van, along with Brandy, our Doberman, and assorted luggage. Though we would stop for gas twice in those 10 hours, we never bought food or drinks. Instead, our meals consisted of ham sandwiches, Fritos, and pink lemonade that my mom had brought from home. Those were grand times. Our parents never required us to wear seatbelts. Are you really surprised by that revelation? And we'd read, play games, or wrestle in the back as we zipped down Highway 5, heading for Grandma Sparks's house. I don't mean the kind of wrestling where we'd poke each other and whine. I mean real wrestling, complete with headlocks, punches, twisted arms and legs, and punctuated with screams and tears. Usually my parents would ignore it for a while, but sometimes it got to the point that Dad would finally look over his shoulder and scream at us to stop shaking the G-damn van, thereby initiating the inevitable DEFCON countdown, which we never seemed able to avoid. And of course we'd stare at our father as if he had cornstalks growing out of his ears, wondering what on earth could have possibly upset him. "It was your fault," Micah would hiss. "You shouldn't have cried." "But you were hurting me," I'd say. "You need to learn to be tougher." "You were twisting my ear. I thought you were ripping it off." "You're exaggerating. You're an idiot." His eyes narrowed. "What did you call me?" "He called you an idiot," Dana would helpfully add. Micah would glower. "I'll show you who the idiot is," at which point the wrestling would begin again. I often tell people that we never actually drove to San Diego. For the most part, the van sort of hopped there. We were also country comes to town when it came to visiting our cousins. Their families tended to be better off financially than we were, and as soon as we arrived, we'd go blasting through the door toward the cousin's bedroom. Beyond the door, we knew, was Nirvana itself, and we'd simply stare for a moment in wonder. little tears welling in the corners of our eyes. They had more toys than we'd ever seen, and we quickly made good use of them. "Hey, what's this?" we'd ask, grabbing something. Soon we'd be wiggling pieces trying to figure it out. "It's the new battery-operated construction crane," my cousin would proudly exclaim. "It can assemble entire houses from scratch. Snap." The cousin would freeze in horror at the sight of the toy in two pieces. "What happened?" we'd ask.
You broke it," he'd whimper.
"Oh, sorry about that. Hey, what's this one do? It's the new electronically enhanced remote control car complete with..." Snap. "Oh, sorry," we'd say again. "Hey, what's this?" Once the toys were broken, we always wondered how so many accidents could happen in such a short time, we'd try to play with our cousins. Not that they viewed it as playing. We did nothing with them that we didn't do back home. To us, it was regular fun. But to them, it bordered on merciless torture. None of them, it seemed, had lived a childhood like ours, i.e. one without real rules. We thought it great fun, for instance, rolling the little ones up in area rugs until they were pinned and suffocated, unable to move. Then my brother and I would take turns launching ourselves from the couch onto the soft bulge where their bodies were and screaming, "Bingo!" whenever we really crunched them. Or we might dunk them in the pool, really dunk them, for a long, long time until they nearly passed out. Sometimes we'd try to teach our cousins how to punch hard, demonstrating on their little arms. "No, not like that. Cock your arm way back and really use the knuckle like this. Pow!" If there was one thing wrong with visiting my cousins, and it pains me to admit it since they're family, it's that they were whiners. They cried all the time when we were around. It's a wonder how their parents ever dealt with it. Anyway, the visit would eventually come to an end, and it would be time to leave. We'd head to the van, and we'd turn around to see our cousins ghost white and trembling as they waved goodbye to us, their little arms covered in bruises. "See you next year," we'd call out. Later on the way back to Grandma's, my brother would ask, "What were they doing with their faces when we left?" "You mean the way they were blinking and squinching and tilting suddenly to the side?" "Yeah." "I don't know. Must be a facial tic of some sort." Micah would shake his head. "Those poor kids. They weren't like that when we got there. Must have come on suddenly." The trips themselves were always an adventure, too. Once when we took off for San Diego, my father had $21 in his wallet. That was it. The entire sum he'd brought for the family for an entire week's vacation. As fate would have it, the van broke down in the Tehachapi Mountains, about an hour north of Los Angeles. We were towed to the only service station nearby, where we learned that the van had an oil leak. The part would take at least a week to arrive, but the mechanic thought he could weld something together overnight that might allow us to reach our destination. Of course, it would cost money, something my dad didn't have. My dad had a funny, almost contradictory relationship with money. Oh, I suppose that he wanted more of it, but when push came to shove, he had no idea about how to go about earning more. At the same time, he never wanted to think about money, but because of our family situation, was always forced to do so. Everything had to be budgeted, and this breakdown was not in the budget. To say he was angry was an understatement. He was downright scary. He totally bypassed the DEFCON countdown and went straight to nuclear launch. He called his mom in San Diego, who promised to wire him the money needed for repairs, but the repairs wouldn't be completed until the following day. He spent the day pacing back and forth, whistling the tune of the dead, his tongue curled out of his mouth. Later that afternoon, we ate the last of the ham sandwiches and Fritos, and finished the lemonade, further enraging my father. Without money to buy food or even stay in a hotel, we ended up sleeping in the back of the van with the dog that night. When we woke, there was no money for breakfast either. We wouldn't eat until we reached San Diego the following afternoon. Still, that wasn't the worst part about our stay, nor was it our dad's anger. When I think about that particular trip, my memories always drift back to the first day, an hour or so after we'd arrived at the garage. As I said, my father was beyond furious at that time, and we'd learned to keep our distance in moments like those. With nothing else to do, my brother, sister, and I decided to see what the town had to offer, but quickly learned that there wasn't much. The place was more a run-down rest stop than an actual town. It was hot as blazes with only a handful of decrepit buildings lining the highway in either direction, and not a stitch of shade. There wasn't even a coffee shop or diner with a television perched in a corner that might help pass the time.
It was one of the first times we'd actually been bored. Thankfully, we soon came across a dog who seemed to enjoy our attention. We spent a few minutes petting him. He was incredibly friendly, bouncy, and happy. And we took to calling him Sparky, after us, of course. In time, he scrambled to his feet, and we watched him begin to trot away, tongue hanging out, looking pleased as punch. He glanced back at us, almost smiling, I still believe, and headed toward the road, where he was instantly struck by a car going 60 miles an hour. We witnessed every detail. We heard the thump and watched the dog twist unnaturally before careening toward us, blood flying from his mouth, and skidding to a stop less than a couple of feet away. The car simply slowed. It didn't stop. The family in the car looked as horrified as we were. A moment later, after whining and whimpering and heaving a final breath, Sparky died at our feet. With my dad in such a foul mood and my mom trying to keep him calm, all we could do was handle the latest horror the way we always had, with each other, as siblings. Just three little kids on the side of a highway, holding each other and crying, trying to understand why terrible things happened. Chapter 8. Cusco, Machu Picchu, Peru. January 27th to 28th. After our brief stop in Lima, we prepared to travel to Cusco, the oldest permanent settlement in the Western Hemisphere, and the former capital of the Inca Empire. With a population of 275,000, it's a city resplendent with adobe houses, red tile roofs, winding cobblestone streets, magnificent cathedrals and open markets, and as we flew over the city, both Micah and I were struck by its beauty. On the flight, we were warned about altitude sickness. Nestled in the Andes, Cusco was situated at 11,500 feet, and we were told to move slowly as we exited the plane. The members of the TCS crew stood in various sections of the terminal, repeating their warnings over and over as our group filed past. Take it easy. Don't get out of breath. Go slow. You'd think we were climbing Mount Everest, Micah whispered, not walking through an airport. I nodded, agreeing that the whole thing was ridiculous. Maybe some of the people might be affected, but we were young and in relatively good shape. Ignoring their warnings, we walked at our normal pace and ended up having to wait quite a while for everyone else to arrive at the buses. While we were waiting, however, a concerned look crossed Micah's face. He took a couple of deep breaths. You know, I think I can actually feel it, he said. Really? A little bit. It kind of makes me feel fuzzy. In the end, it made us both feel really fuzzy, like we'd had a few too many beers. For whatever reason, we started giggling and couldn't stop. Everything struck us as outrageously funny as we rode on the bus. The clothes the people were wearing, the bumpy cobblestone roads that made our voices vibrate, and especially the name of the place we were just about to visit. Sacsayhuaman. When pronounced correctly, Sacsayhuaman, it sounded like someone with a Russian accent trying to say, sexy woman. In our addled state, we couldn't drop the subject. It was all we could talk about. I just can't wait until we see the Sacsayhuaman, Micah would say, and my oxygen-starved brain would make me double over in laughter. I wonder where the Sacsayhuaman is, he'd add. You know I love nothing more than a Sacsayhuaman. Please, just quit, okay? I'd plead. I really want to climb on a Sacsayhuaman. You know Peru is famous for the Sacsayhuaman. By then, I had tears in my eyes. We had lunch at our hotel in Cusco. Once a monastery, it was one of the most interesting hotels we would visit. Like Casa Aliaga, it was designed around a center courtyard, albeit on a much grander scale. Originally built in 1640, the rooms had been modified to allow oxygen to be pumped in. As Micah observed when we entered the lobby, "This is even better than a Sacsayhuaman." In the afternoon, after the giggles had subsided, we finally got a chance to visit the Incan fortress. It wasn't exactly what we expected. Situated on a large open plateau just above Cusco, it was ringed by rock walls on either side, more like an amphitheater than a defensive fort. The walls had been formed using giant blocks of granite, and the stones had been so precisely cut and stacked that even today it's impossible to slip a piece of paper between them. Above us, heavy clouds lent the landscape an ominous appearance. We wandered the area with Bob and Kate Devlin, who had rapidly become good friends. As we listened to the guide talking about the intricate stone construction, they informed us they'd recently celebrated their 41st anniversary.
A little while later, while Micah and I were exploring on our own, we saw Bob and Kate standing together in the distance. For a while, we simply watched them.
"They look happy, don't they?" Micah asked.
"Yeah, they do. I think that's because they really are happy."
40 years is a long time. They've been married longer than I've been alive.
So I have a lot of people on this trip.
"What do you think the secret of a long-lasting marriage is?" Micah asked.
"I don't know if there's a secret. Every couple is different. What works for one might not work for another."
"I know, but if you could pick one thing, what would it be?"
I hesitated. Above me, the sky was charcoal. Clouds were rolling and shifting, changing shape by the minute.
"Commitment," I finally said.
"Both people have to be committed. I think if two people are committed to the marriage, if they really want to make it work, then they'll find a way to do it. No matter what happens in life. If you marry someone who isn't committed, or if you're not committed, and something goes wrong, the marriage won't make it. Marriage is hard."
"Hmm," is all Micah said.
"How about you? What do you think the secret is?"
"I have no idea. I've only been married 4 years. But for me and Christine, I think it's communication. When we talk about issues and really open up to each other, things are great between us. When we keep things to ourselves, grudges and resentments build up and we end up arguing."
I said nothing.
"What? You don't think communication is important?"
I shrugged.
"What good is talking if neither of you are really committed? If one of you had an affair or got addicted to drugs or was abusive, simply talking about it wouldn't take the hurt away or fix the trust that's been lost. In the end, marriage comes down to actions. I think people talk too much about the things that bother them instead of actually doing the little things that keep a marriage strong. You have to know what your spouse needs from you, and then you do it. And you avoid doing the things that harm the relationship. If your spouse acts the same way, your marriage can make it through anything."
He smiled.
"Like you and Kat?"
"Yeah," I said quietly.
"Like me and Kat."
After the fortress of Sacsayhuaman, we headed back to tour the main cathedral of Cusco, where the wealth was enough to stagger the imagination. Larger than St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, the cathedral was home to hundreds of frescoes and oil paintings of religious figures, while gold and silver glittered everywhere. Not only were the massive altars plated in precious metals, but entire walls as well. When one considers that the Spanish sent the vast majority of the wealth back to Spain, it was easy to understand why Pizarro had been so intent on conquering the Incas. As fascinating as the church was, Micah seemed fixated on a particular item. With effort, he got the guide's attention.
Where's the painting of Jesus eating the guinea pig?" Micah asked.
Guinea pigs, we learned, aren't regarded as pets in Peru. Instead, they're regarded as a delicacy and are roasted for celebratory occasions. When the early Spanish missionaries were working to convert the Incas to Catholicism, they'd had to blend the religion with local culture as a way to make it more palatable to the natives. Thus, when the missionaries commissioned a painting of the Last Supper, one has to wonder whether they were surprised by what the artist assumed Jesus had eaten. We soon found ourselves staring up at the painting of Jesus surrounded by his disciples. In addition to the bread and the wine, there on the platter in front of him was a roasted guinea pig. As we were staring at it, Micah leaned over to me.
"Did you know Allie's classroom has a guinea pig for a pet?"
"She does?
Oh yeah, she's gonna love this."
Micah surreptitiously snapped a photograph. Museums. Everywhere we went, we were taken to museums, so we could see the artifacts representing the history of the native peoples. In all honesty, many were quite boring. We learned, for instance, that nearly every culture in the past had, surprise, pottery. Consequently, we spent a lot of time looking at jars and bowls. No matter how you sliced it, after a while this was about as exciting as looking at jars and bowls in your own kitchen cupboard. Yet our guides loved jars and bowls. It seemed like they could talk about jars and bowls for hours. They spoke with reverence about jars and bowls. "And this is the jar they use to store water," they'd say. "And now, over here, notice how different it is when compared to one used to store their wine. Can you see the different shape and color? It's even a different size. It's amazing to comprehend how advanced they were as a civilization. Different liquids, different jars. Just imagine it."
"Wow," Micah would echo.
"Just imagine it."
"I'm trying to," I'd add.
"Different liquids, different jars. It boggles the mind, doesn't it?" Occasionally, we'd learn something truly intriguing. Bones, for instance, usually made us pause. And weapons and skulls, especially the skulls. In the Cusco Museum, there was a collection of skulls behind glass. Though the placards were in Spanish, we were able to decipher a bit of the exhibit and make out the word surgery. Our guide wasn't nearly as excited about the skulls and the idea of primitive surgery as we were. He seemed to want to downplay what Micah and I were seeing as if it somehow cast doubt on the gentility of the early Incas. "This is not important," he urged. "Come, let me show you the jars and bowls. There are more up ahead." "We'll catch up," we said. It turns out the Incas engaged in brain surgery, which fascinated us. We could see the holes where they'd bored through the skulls. The holes were as big as quarters, and from the number of skulls and variations in the placement of the holes, it wasn't an uncommon practice. As we stared at them, I tried to imagine what the patient must have been going through or what the chief said when explaining why the surgery was necessary.
You've been depressed, huh? Well, I'm pretty sure you have animal spirits between your ears. I think we'd better dig them out."
"Okay, chief, as long as you know what you're doing."
"Of course I know what I'm doing. Haven't you seen our jars and bowls? We're an advanced civilization. Now hand me that jaguar bone, lean over the rock, and let me dig in."
"Okie dokie."
The next morning we drove to the train station in Cusco to embark on the ride through the legendary Urubamba Valley on our way to Machu Picchu. Our guides had described the valley views as some of the most beautiful in the world, and our trip was everything it was advertised to be and more. Micah and I spent 3.5 hours gawking through the window, staring up the towering granite cliffsides and marveling at the river that often seemed close enough to touch. In places, it was possible to see Incan ruins that had fallen into disrepair, a wall here, a storage building there. As we first descended through the valley, then started climbing into the Andes, the blue skies gave way to white, mist-filled clouds. The Andes became green with forest, and we disembarked at a ramshackle village perched on the banks of the by-then-raging Urubamba River. It was raining as we made our way down a narrow street crowded with vendors which also served as the town market. From there we boarded a bus that would travel along the narrow switchback roads that ended at Machu Picchu, more than 2,000 feet up. The tale of the lost Incan city, high in the Andes, was regarded as little more than folklore when Hiram Bingham arrived in Peru in 1911. Wanting to prove its existence, he hired local guides and embarked on a quest to find it. The guides had been chosen because they supposedly knew its location, and after making their way through the valley, they eventually led him to a cliff whose top was shrouded in the clouds. As he and his team made their way up, they met a few natives who remarked on the houses just around the corner. Within minutes, Bingham soon came across the ruins of the fabled city, one that was estimated to have housed more than 2,500 people. To this day, no one is sure why the city had been built. It may have served as an outpost against invading Spanish marauders. Other discoveries suggest that it may have been a place where the king rested, much like a vacation hideaway. Others have pointed to evidence that most of the occupants were women, which further complicates the theories. What is known is that the city was abandoned soon after the Spanish arrived. Micah and I got off the bus, and at first the mist and cloud cover was thick enough to prevent us from seeing anything. Instead, as we were snaking along the edge of a cliff, the ruins materialized slowly, almost as if being casually unveiled. First, nothing was in focus. Gradually, images formed. Then, all at once, we could see everything, and it was enough to stun us into silence. Part of the impact of Machu Picchu is due to sheer location. While some of the ruins are at the top of the mountain, other parts are built directly into the sides of the cliff. Terraces look like giant steps carved out of the cliffside, and just beyond them are the granite block dwellings and temples of the ancient Incas. The roofs, originally made of wooden thatch, have long since decayed, but we could see the structures themselves. Interconnected like apartments in places, steep steps interweave among the buildings. Places to worship dotted the settlement with open areas complete with sacrificial slabs. All around us, the lush slopes of the Andes towered in the distance. Wisps of cloud snaked through the peaks. If we'd been amazed by Tikal, we were literally rendered speechless by the architecture of Machu Picchu. It would be my favorite stop on the entire journey. We made our way through the ruins with a guide on hand to tell us about the history and culture. Yet over and over, I felt compelled to break away from the group, simply to stand alone for a while. It was the kind of place that one should experience, not simply visit. Micah felt the same way. At one point, we sat quietly on the edge of one of the ruins with our feet dangling over, drinking in the spectacular view, neither of us feeling the urge to break the silence. Over the next few hours, we continued to explore the ruins. Afterward, we were supposed to have lunch in the restaurant. Micah and I would have stayed on.